All right, welcome back everyone to the Deep Dive. Today we're going to be really digging into a case that I think highlights a really critical aspect of your Sixth Amendment rights.
Yeah.
And this is the Beats v. Collins case.
Ah, an interesting one for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really kind of zooms in on this idea of conflicts of interest in criminal defense, right?
Oh, no, absolutely. And, it's not just some abstract legal concept, right? We're talking about real people facing very serious consequences.
Absolutely, yeah. And by the end of this deep dive today, I'm hoping that you'll walk away with a clearer understanding of like what actually constitutes a conflict of interest legally speaking, and what are some of the like the potential pitfalls, right? Not just for defendants, but for their attorneys as well. So just to get everyone oriented, we're talking about the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, but this case really adds this layer of complexity about the quality of that representation, right? Mm. It's not just about having a lawyer. It's about having a lawyer who can effectively represent your interests without being pulled in different directions by their own personal interests.
You got it. And that's where this idea of conflict of interest comes into play. It's about ensuring that the scales of justice are balanced, that your lawyer is truly advocating for you and not letting their own interests tip the scales against you.
Exactly. Yeah. So before we get too deep into the weeds, legally speaking, I think it's helpful to kind of start with the facts of the case itself.
Always a good place to begin. Ground ourselves in the story, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So let's talk about Betty Lou Beats.
Okay. So Betty Lou Beats was convicted in 1983, and she was given a death sentence. And this is for the murder of her fifth husband. Fifth husband. Jimmy Down Beats. I know, right?
That's a lot to unpack right there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you've got a lot of questions already.
And of course, as with many cases that involve these serious crimes, there's always a lot of focus on motive. No. So what was the prosecution's theory here?
Well, they were going for a very straightforward motive.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Cold, hard cash.
Yeah.
They argued that Betty Lou killed her husband for his insurance money and his pension benefits.
So classic sort of like, Black Widow type scenario.
Yeah, you could say that. But here's where it gets really complicated and messy, even more so than you might expect in a case like this.
Okay, lay it on me.
Her own lawyer, a guy named E. Ray Andrews, his actions during the trial, they just really raise a lot of questions.
Okay, so this isn't just a case about whether she committed the crime, but also about whether she received a fair trial with competent legal representation.
You got it. And there are two big issues that surround this attorney, E. Ray Andrews.
Okay.
First, there's this question of whether he should have even stayed on the case at all.
Yeah.
Because it turns out there was a chance, a real chance, that he might have needed to testify himself.
Oh, that's a big no-no in the legal world.
Huge red flag, yeah.
Yep.
I mean, how can you effectively represent your client when you're potentially a key witness in the case?
Right, you're kind of in two roles at once.
Exactly. And that just screams conflict of interest.
Okay. So that's problem number one. What's the second issue with this lawyer?
Okay, buckle up for this one.
Okay.
So in the middle of the trial, he goes and signs this media rights deal.
Oh, wow.
And not for himself, mind you.
Oh, no.
The contract was for his son.
Okay, yeah, as you're describing this, I'm already getting this, like, icky feeling,
Yeah, right?
Like, it just doesn't pass the smell test.
Doesn't sound right.
Yeah. And this is all happening while he was supposed to be representing this woman facing a potential death sentence?
Yep, that's exactly right. So you can see why this whole situation has raised some serious concerns about whether she got a fair shake in court with a lawyer whose interests were truly aligned with hers.
Yeah, so let's break down these two issues with the lawyer a bit more. Starting with this potential testimony, the prosecution is arguing that Beats was motivated by money, right?
Right.
So how does the possibility of her own lawyer needing to testify even fit into that whole narrative?
Well, the potential testimony from Andrews, the lawyer, revolved around whether Betty Lou actually knew about those death benefits, the insurance and pension, right from the start.
Okay, so it gets to the heart of the motive, her knowledge of the potential financial gain.
Exactly. Apparently, after her husband went missing, Andrews had some early conversations with her about insurance stuff. And according to the defense, she seemed totally clueless about any significant payout.
Oh, so that would contradict the prosecution's whole theory. If she didn't even know about the money, how could she have been motivated by it?
Exactly. That's the point the defense was trying to make. And the idea was that Andrews could take the stand himself and tell the jury about these initial interactions, bolstering their argument that she wasn't driven by financial gain.
But he didn't testify. So how did they argue that this created a conflict that impacted Beetz's rights?
The argument boils down to this. Andrews had potentially valuable evidence that could have helped his client.
Okay.
But by choosing not to withdraw from the case and testify, he basically put his own interest in staying on as lead counsel ahead of his client's interest in presenting the strongest possible defense.
So it's a classic whose interests are being served here kind of question.
Right. It creates this appearance, at least, that he's prioritizing his own professional role over the needs of his client.
Got it. And then there's this media rights deal with his son. I mean, come on, that just seems wrong on so many levels. What was the argument that this actually created a conflict of interest legally?
Well, the worry with this media deal is that it could have, even subconsciously, right, influenced Andrew's decisions and actions during the entire trial.
Yeah.
Like, was he pushing for a more sensationalized defense, even if it wasn't the best strategy for Betty Lou, just because it would make a better story?
Oh, wow. So it's like, is he putting on a show for the cameras rather than focusing on what's best for his client?
Exactly. And the fear is that his son's financial stake in those media rights could have shaped the advice Andrews gave, the way he questioned witnesses, you name it.
That's so disturbing to think that a lawyer's personal financial interests or even their families could potentially be influencing their decisions in such a high stakes case.
Right. You're talking about someone's life here.
Yeah.
And that's why these conflict of interest issues are so crucial to understand. They can really undermine the fairness of the whole legal process.
Absolutely. So we've got these two main issues that cast doubt on Andrews's representation of Beetz. Now, let's shift gears a bit and talk about how all of this played out in the legal system.
Okay, so like with any legal case, there's a whole process of appeals and reviews, right? So let's walk through that.
Yeah, because it didn't just end with her initial conviction.
Right. No, not at all.
So what happened next?
Well, first, she goes through the usual appeals process in the Texas state courts.
Hmm.
But those appeals, they don't go anywhere.
Unsuccessful.
Yeah.
Okay, so what then, I mean, what happens when you've exhausted all your appeals at the state level?
Well, then you can try to take your case to the federal courts.
Okay.
And that's exactly what Betty Lou did. She filed something called a petition for a writ of habeas corpus.
A habeas corpus petition. Now, remind our listeners what that is exactly.
Right, because it sounds super technical.
Yeah.
Basically, it's a way for someone in prison to challenge whether they're being held there legally.
Okay, so it's a way to say, hey, court, you're keeping me locked up, but you shouldn't be because, and then they give their reasons.
Exactly. And in Betty Lou's case, her argument was that she didn't get a fair trial because of her lawyer's conflicts of interest.
Right. Those two big issues we've been discussing.
And guess what? The federal district court actually agreed with her.
No way.
They found that Andrews did have an actual conflict of interest that negatively impacted how he represented her.
So at that point, it seemed like she might actually get some relief, like a new trial or something.
Yeah, it was looking that way. But, you know, legal battles, they rarely have simple endings.
So there's more.
Oh, yeah. The state of Texas, they weren't about to just let that ruling stand.
Of course.
So they appealed to the next level, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. And that's where things took a turn.
Okay, so let's dive into what the Fifth Circuit did. What was their reasoning for ultimately rejecting the conflict of interest claims? Let's start with that issue of Andrews potentially needing to testify himself.
All right, so the Fifth Circuit, they looked at the whole situation and concluded that Andrews choosing not to testify, it seemed like a strategic move.
A strategic move?
Yeah, like maybe he thought it would be more effective to have someone else present that information.
I mean, but couldn't you argue that the lawyer, the person who actually had those initial conversations with Beetz about the insurance, wouldn't his testimony carry more weight?
Well, yeah, you could definitely argue that.
Okay.
But the court's reasoning hinged on the fact that another witness, Bruce Roberts, had already testified about basically the same thing.
Oh, that Mead seemed unaware of the death benefits initially.
Yep. So they basically said that Andrews' testimony would have been cumulative. Like, it wouldn't have added anything new to what the jury already heard.
Okay, so they used this legal doctrine, the cumulative testimony doctrine, to justify that decision.
Exactly.
But it still feels like a subtle distinction, you know? Like, yeah, the information might be similar, but wouldn't hearing it directly from the lawyer who was actually there have a different impact on the jury?
I mean, you could certainly make that case. But the court stuck to this no actual conflict idea. They were saying, sure, he could have testified, but because the essential information was already out there, it wasn't a real conflict that deprived Beetz of some crucial piece of evidence.
Right, the emphasis being on actual as opposed to just potential.
That's precise.
Okay, that makes sense in the context of their ruling, I guess. Now, what about that meteorite's contract with his son. I mean, ethically, that just screams trouble to me. How did the Fifth Circuit address that?
So the Fifth Circuit, they didn't totally brush aside the ethical concerns. They acknowledged that this kind of arrangement, it's not ideal. It could potentially lead to problems.
Right.
But they focused their analysis on whether this potential for conflict actually turned into an actual conflict that actually harmed Beetz's defense.
So they're making a distinction between something that might be ethically questionable and something that actually rises to the level of a constitutional violation.
Exactly.
Okay, and what did they decide?
They said that Beetz hadn't shown enough evidence to prove that this media contract actually affected Andrews's performance as her lawyer.
So in their view, ethically problematic maybe, but a constitutional violation, not so much.
You got it. And the timing of the contract was really important for them. They pointed out that it was signed after the trials had already started, and importantly, after the main defense strategy was already in place.
Oh, so they're saying even if this contract did create some sort of bias or incentive for Andrews, it couldn't have affected the overall direction of the defense because that was already set.
Precisely. Huh. They didn't see any evidence that it influenced how he questioned witnesses or any other key decision during the trial.
So the Fifth Circuit is really drawing a line in the sand here, saying that just because something looks bad, just because it raises ethical concerns, doesn't automatically mean that it violated the defendant's constitutional rights.
Yeah, that's the big takeaway here. The Sixth Amendment, it's focused on actual conflicts that affect the defense, not just hypothetical ones or ethical missteps that didn't actually change anything.
Okay, so there's a difference between a lawyer maybe not acting in the most ethical way and a lawyer actually being so bad that it violates their client's Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel.
Right, and the court is saying, in this case, with those two issues with Andrews, they didn't meet that high bar.
And there was another interesting wrinkle in this case, right?
Oh, yeah. You're talking about the concurring opinion from one of the judges.
Yeah. So one of the judges on the panel, he agreed with the outcome, but he had a slightly different take on how to analyze these conflict claims.
Yeah. So he basically said that he didn't think the framework from Kyler v. Sullivan was the right fit for this case.
Now, remind me, what was Kyler v. Sullivan about again?
So Kyler, it usually deals with conflicts that pop up when one lawyer is representing multiple defendants at the same time, and those defendants might have interests that clash.
Okay, so like if two people are accused of robbing a bank together and they both have the same lawyer, there's a potential for conflict there.
Exactly. But this judge in Beetz, he thought the situation with Andrews was more like a regular claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. Like, he wasn't saying there wasn't a problem, but he thought it should be analyzed under the Strickland v. Washington standard.
And Strickland, that's the big case that sets out the two-prong test for proving ineffective assistance of counsel, right?
Right. The lawyer's performance has to be deficient, and that deficiency has to have prejudiced the defendant's case.
So this judge is basically saying, even if Andrews's actions didn't rise to the level of an actual conflict under Kyler, maybe they were still so bad that they were ineffective assistance of counsel under Strickland.
Yeah, that's essentially his point. It's a subtle distinction, but it shows that even among judges, there can be different views on how to apply these legal frameworks.
And that's why studying case law is so fascinating, right? It's not always black and white.
Exactly. You have to really understand the nuances, the arguments on both sides to see how these cases shape the law.
All right, so we've walked through what happened in court, we've talked about the different legal arguments, and now I think it's time to sort of step back and really unpack some of the key concepts that this case highlights, right? Because these aren't just abstract legal ideas, they have real-world implications for how criminal defendants are represented.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the most important things to understand is the difference between an actual conflict of interest and a potential conflict. You know, we've been using these terms throughout the discussion, but what do they really mean in practice?
Right, because they sound similar, but legally, there's a big difference, right?
Huge difference. It all comes down to how much the lawyer's personal interests actually impacted their representation.
Okay.
So a potential conflict is when there's a chance, a possibility, that the lawyer's interests might clash with their client's interests.
Okay, so it's like a red flag, something to watch out for, but it doesn't necessarily mean the representation was bad.
Exactly. But an actual conflict, that's when you have proof that this clash actually happened and that it negatively affected how the lawyer handled the case.
So in Beetz's case, the court saw the potential testimony issue and the media contract as potential conflicts, but they didn't find enough evidence to say they were actual conflicts that harmed her defense.
Right. And that's a really high bar to clear. You can't just say, well, it looks bad, therefore it must have impacted the case. You have to show concretely how the lawyer's actions were influenced by that conflict and how that hurt the client.
Okay, that makes sense. And you mentioned earlier this cumulative testimony doctrine. Can you explain a bit more about why that was so important in the court's decision about Andrews not testifying?
Sure. Basically, the idea is that if the information a potential witness could give has already been presented to the court through other evidence, then that witness not testifying is less likely to be a problem for the defendant.
Okay, so it's like if the jury already heard the same thing from someone else, it doesn't really matter if the lawyer also says it.
Yeah, that's a simplified way to think about it.
Yeah.
And in Beetz's case, because Bruce Roberts had already testified about her not knowing about the death benefits, the court didn't think it was a big deal that Andrews didn't also testify about it.
Got it. So it's all about whether the absence of that specific testimony actually deprived the defendant of something crucial. Now, this distinction between ethical violations and constitutional violations, I think this is one of the trickiest parts of this whole discussion. You know, when we hear about a lawyer doing something that seems ethically wrong, it's easy to assume that their client's rights have been violated.
Oh, absolutely. And it's understandable, right? Like, if your lawyer's doing shady stuff, it feels like you can't possibly be getting a fair shake. But the law looks at these two things differently.
Okay, so break that down for us. What's the difference between an ethical violation and a constitutional violation in this context?
All right, so ethical rules, they're like the rules of the road for lawyers.
Yeah.
They're meant to ensure that lawyers act professionally, that they treat their clients fairly, and that they uphold the integrity of the legal system as a whole.
Okay.
And if a lawyer breaks these rules, they can face disciplinary action, like getting reprimanded or even losing their license to practice law.
So there are consequences for ethical violations, but it's separate from the Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
Exactly. The Sixth Amendment is focused on whether the lawyer's performance was so bad that it actually prejudiced the defendant's case. It's a performance-based standard.
Okay.
So while an ethical breach might be a factor in determining whether a lawyer was constitutionally ineffective, it's not an automatic slam dunk.
Got it. So in Beetz, the court might have thought the media contract was ethically questionable, but they didn't find enough evidence to say it actually made Andrews a worse lawyer for her in a way that affected the outcome of her trial.
Exactly. And I think that's a really important point for both lawyers and clients to understand. Ethical rules are important, but the Sixth Amendment is concerned with ensuring a fair trial. And that means focusing on whether the lawyer's performance actually made a difference in the case.
And you mentioned earlier that the court also found the lack of investigation into Beetz's background to be troubling.
Right.
But they didn't ultimately find it sufficient to support a Sixth Amendment claim. Why was that?
Well, remember the two-prong test from Strickland that we talked about?
Deficient performance and prejudice to the defendant.
Right. Even if you can show that the lawyer messed up, you also have to show that that mess up actually harmed the defendant's case.
Okay.
So even if the court thought that Andrews should have done more to investigate Beetz's past, they didn't see enough evidence to say that this lack of investigation actually changed the outcome of her trial.
So it's not enough to say, well, my lawyer could have done more. You have to show that what they didn't do actually made a difference.
Exactly. You have to show that there's a reasonable probability that the result would have been different if the lawyer had done their job properly.
Okay, so that's a really high burden for the defendant to meet. So, zooming out now, what are some of the bigger lessons that we can take away from this Beetz v. Collins case? What should our listeners, especially those interested in criminal law, really understand about this case?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway is that proving a Sixth Amendment violation based on a conflict of interest is really hard.
Mm.
It's not enough to just point to something that looks bad or raises ethical questions.
Mm.
You have to show that there was an actual conflict, not just a potential one, and that this conflict actually made a difference in the case.
Right, so it's not just about whether the lawyer acted ethically, it's about whether their actions actually impacted the outcome of the trial.
Exactly. And I think this case also serves as a cautionary tale for lawyers.
Mm.
It shows that even if something might not technically violate the Sixth Amendment, it can still raise ethical concerns and damage the public's perception of the legal profession.
Yeah, like that media contract with Andrews' son. Even though the court didn't find it to be a constitutional violation, it still doesn't look good.
Right. It just creates this appearance that the lawyer might be putting their own interest ahead of their clients.
And that's something that lawyers need to be really careful about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They need to be mindful of how their actions might be perceived, not just whether they're technically within the bounds of the law.
So to sum up our deep dive into Beetz v. Collins, the main takeaway is this. If you're going to argue that your Sixth Amendment rights were violated because your lawyer had a conflict of interest, you need to be able to show that this conflict was real and that it actually harmed your defense. Just pointing to something that seems unethical or unwise isn't enough.
Right. The Sixth Amendment is about protecting the right to a fair trial. And that means focusing on whether the lawyer's actions actually made a difference in the case.
And that leaves us with a final thought for our listeners to ponder. Given this distinction between ethical concerns and constitutional violations, how should the legal profession balance the need for ethical conduct among its members with the sometimes very high bar for proving ineffective assistance of counsel?
It's a tough question, but it's one that we need to keep grappling with. Because at the end of the day, it's about ensuring that everyone, regardless of their circumstances, has access to truly effective legal representation.
Absolutely, and that's what the Sixth Amendment is all about. All right, folks, that's it for today's deep dive into Beetz v. Collins. As always, thanks for listening.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll see you next time.
See you then.